You are listening to Pastor Talk.
So that narrative sort of pushes us out into to speak and act in ways that please the Lord. And Newbegin wanted us to make sure that we did go out into public and speak and act on behalf of Christ and try to shape cultural realities in a way that would please the Lord. But he also wanted to make sure that we weren't triumphalistic about it and that it will be Christ who truly transforms.
Welcome to Pastor Talk, the podcast of Lifeway Pastors, giving you the tools and encouragement you need to shepherd your flock well. I'm your host, Marty Duren. My guest today on Pastor Talk is Dr. Bruce Ashford. Bruce is a returning guest. He's the provost and professor of theology and culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina. He's the author of Every Square Inch, An Introduction to Cultural Engagement for Christians, and One Nation Under God, A Christian Hope for American Politics. Bruce is a ceaseless blogger at bruceashford.net. He's also a research fellow at the ERLC, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, and a fellow in theology at St. George's Center for Biblical and Public Theology, and a participant in the Dulles Colloquium of the Institute of Religion and Public Life. He's married and has three kids, and I'm really happy Bruce is back with us today. It's my privilege to welcome back to Pastor Talk Dr. Bruce Ashford from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. How are things in Wake Forest today, Bruce?
We're having a great time over here. Thanks for having me back on the show, Marty.
It's always a pleasure because you've always got good things to say. So we're going to be talking today about missional engagement in the political sphere using Leslie Newbegin as a, I don't even know if I say his name. Does anybody actually say his name right?
You know, you nailed it, Marty. You crushed it. His name is Leslie Newbegin, just like you mentioned. And he's an important guy, you know, this man named Leslie. And I'm glad that we get a chance to talk about him today.
Now, I was introduced to Newbegin about maybe 10 years ago. I did not study him in Bible college. Nobody in my home church recommended him to me. If I'm not mistaken, his books began being published maybe in the 70s through the 80s because he's been dead for some time now. Why don't you kind of get everybody up to date on who he is? A lot of people may not be familiar with him. He is British and wrote from that perspective and I think even published originally there. So who is Leslie Newbegin and why are we talking about a missional approach to the political sphere with him as a reference point?
Yeah, so Newbegin has a fascinating life story. You know, he's a British Anglican who was a relatively conservative guy in the midst of a very liberal mainstream denomination. And he was involved in the World Council of Churches, which was very much left-leaning compared to, you know, our evangelical circles. That's why most people haven't heard of him. But here's what I love about his life story. He was a missionary to India for more than three decades. And there in India, he honed his ability to preach the gospel and to tell the Bible's story and to persuade and to convince people who held a very different worldview from, you know, the worldview that he held. So when he retired and came back to the UK, I think he was in his late 60s, he realized that the most pressing need he had was to help bring the West into a missionary encounter with the gospel. Mm-hmm. And he drew upon the things he learned when he was a missionary to India to begin viewing himself as a missionary to the UK and to the West. And I think that's where he is a really helpful coach for us, if you will. There's two concepts that he talked about a lot that I want to mention. He talked about the first is bringing the West into a missionary encounter with the gospel. So in the West, we tend to not bring people into a missionary encounter with the gospel, especially in public life, because a missionary approaches a new context with humility, takes the time to listen and really learn about that context, finds common ground, and then works from the common ground to persuade someone about Christ. I think a lot of times we take kind of an opposite approach where we feel like we own our nation, the United States of America, and that people ought to believe what we believe. And sometimes we're kind of reprimanding or we view ourselves as enemies of people who believe differently than we do.
Now, are you saying that a little humility might be in order?
Yeah, a little humility might be in order.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
So Newbegin's just saying, listen, the plausibility structures in society are against us. Mm-hmm. In other words, most people in our society consider the gospel implausible, not just wrong, but not even plausible, mm-hmm. or many people do, an increasing number of people do. So let's view the United States as a missionary context and help bring it into a missionary encounter with the gospel.
Okay. He served in India from, I'm thinking, the 30s to the 60s or the 40s to the 70s, it seems to me. I just looked, and he died in 98, so nearly 20 years ago now. And for the last part of his life, he's living in Britain with the same mindset that he lived with in India. When you think about how to reach the culture around you, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And then, you know, the neat thing is he did almost all of his publishing after he left the mission field. The guy was already old when he came back to the UK. I mean, I say old. I mean, he was fairly
advanced. Watch it, buddy. You're treading on some thin ice right there.
I mean, no offense, Marty. I'm sorry. But yeah, he published, you know, a book or two a year for the last two decades of his life. Pretty amazing stuff.
So speaking of books that he's written, I've got a couple of names here. One I'm looking at is The Gospel in a Pluralist Society, which is very relevant to today. He also wrote a book called Foolishness to the Greeks, The Gospel in Western Culture, The Open Secret, and an Introduction to the Theology of Mission. And then here's one I don't have that I want to get, Signs Amid the Rubble, The Purposes of God in Human History. You mentioned that you had a couple of things that he'd written you wanted to bring into the discussion. What are some of the quotes or maybe some of the excerpts you've run across that are really thought-provoking that would be appropriate to share and maybe comment on?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think is helpful is to let Newbegin speak for himself, so that our listeners can kind of hear his voice instead of just, you know, hearing you and me bloviating about him. So one of his primary emphases was allowing the biblical narrative to shape our view of the world. Mm-hmm. So the Bible is the true story of the world, not the story that some news outlet gives or some nation gives in its history textbook, like in the American narrative of the world or the Russian narrative of the world. So here's a quote from an article he wrote entitled Biblical Authority. He said, "We have to soak ourselves in this biblical story so that we more and more understand that it is the real story. And the story that we're listening to on the radio and in our newspapers is to a very large extent phony. So the real issues are the ones we recognize when we let the biblical story shape our thinking. And Christ stands at the center of that story." Then there's another.
So let me while you're finding that, let me just say this sounds like when I was a young man, was the first time I ever heard somebody say all of history is his story, using the play on the letters of the word, that all of history is God's story. And it sounds like Newbegin is saying basically that same thing, but that we should not forget it. It's not just preacher talk. It's one of the things that we need to remember day by day, that we evaluate the news based on the scripture, not the other way around.
Yeah, that's right. We tend to, even committed evangelical believers, Bible-believing Christians, we tend to sort of unconsciously let these sort of American story of the world frame even our biblical beliefs. But as a matter of fact, America is a bit player in the grand sweep of history, mm-hmm. a very small role player, not even mentioned in the Bible. So we want to frame everything that we approach in light of the biblical narrative.
Absolutely.
So that narrative sort of pushes us out to speak and act in ways that please the Lord. And Newbegin wanted us to make sure that we did go out into public and speak and act on behalf of Christ and try to shape cultural realities in a way that would please the Lord. But he also wanted to make sure that we weren't triumphalistic about it, mm-hmm. and that it will be Christ who truly transforms things in the end. So here's a passage where he says, "The point is that a transformed society is not our goal, as great as that is. Our goal is the holy city, the New Jerusalem, a perfect fellowship in which God reigns in every heart, and his children rejoice together in his love and joy. And though we know that we must grow old and die, that our labors, even if they succeed for a while, will in the end be buried in the dust of time, yet we are not dismayed. We know that these things must be. We know that as surely as Christ was raised from the dead, so surely there shall be a new heavens and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness.
And here's the final sentence. And having this knowledge, we ought, as Christians, to be the strength of every good movement of political and social effort, because we have no need either of blind optimism or of despair. And so what he was saying is, we are called as missionaries to our nation and to the West and to the rest of the world. Our main goal isn't to win, and so we shouldn't be blind optimists. But neither, when we face setbacks, neither should we despair. And if we rely upon the biblical narrative as the true story of the whole world, we're not going to lapse into blind optimism on the one hand, or despair on the other. So that gives you a little bit of a taste of Nubian. I mean, there's a lot more, you know, but there's a couple of passages.
Okay, so here's a guy who was a missionary in India. His early ministry would have predated Gandhi, I guess, and through the upheaval and changes related to the British Empire in India and all those things, he comes home. He writes a series of books about how to relate in 1960s, 70s, and 80s England. And here we are now 20 years after his death, not 20 minutes, but 20 years after his death. And we still seem to have a disconnect, whether it be the political realm, or whether it be how to relate to our neighbor, or whether it be the church's role in society as a body. We still seem to be, in many parts of the West, just befuddled at this idea of being missionaries where we are, that missionaries aren't the people that we send. We are the missionaries that God has sent in our own context. So how can we apply Nubian today, maybe in kind of the political sphere? How does being missional in our living apply in a political sphere now in 2017 and beyond?
Yeah, so Nubian, when he got back to the UK, he realized in his day what we're realizing in our own, that Bible-believing Christianity has been decentered socially, culturally, and politically. So we find ourselves, humanly speaking, at a disadvantage, right? We've been marginalized, kind of pushed to the margins a little bit. And Nubian was fond of drawing upon Jesus' statement to his disciples, "As the Father sent me, so I send you."
John 20:21.
And when he said that to his disciples, he held his hands out to them and showed them the hole in his hands and his side. And what he was saying is, listen, if the cosmic king of the universe can serve as a homeless itinerant preacher, and if he can be crucified on a cross, and if he can reign from a position of suffering, then we can minister from that same sort of position. Also, and so that's a paradigm shift for Americans. Unconsciously, we have always viewed ourselves as the majority, and have the approach we've taken is to tell other people, to inform them, and declare to them that they ought to do this or that or the other. And we've done it from a vantage point of being in the majority, but we're no longer in the majority, as I see. So let me give two categories of how we can give public witness in a way that Nubian would fits with Nubian's agenda. The first is to focus on the church gathered, that when we gather on Sunday mornings, that gathering is a deeply and profoundly political assembly. Now, I do not think it's political in the sense of being a public policy mouthpiece. I don't think pastors and churches are generally called or competent to do public policy from the pulpit, or even to sway elections. Per se. I don't think that's the calling of the church. What the church is called to do, and where the church finds its power, is in the proclamation of the gospel, that Jesus is Lord, and by implication, Caesar is not, Congress is not, the president is not. Jesus is Lord. So it's a deeply and profoundly political assembly, and if the preaching of the word and the administration of the Lord's Supper and the rest of our church service is done the way it ought to be done, it calls attention to the fact, and it calls us to celebrate around the fact that Jesus Christ is the cosmic king and that he'll return one day. So Jesus is Lord and Caesar is not. So Sunday morning reminds us that Jesus will return one day, install a one-party system, and with him as at the head of it, and reconstitute the world under a reign of justice and peace. That Sunday morning worship prepares us for Monday morning public life. So that brings us to our second category. which is the church not only gathers, it also scatters. And when we scatter into our everyday lives, where we have our own competencies and our own callings, our own sort of circles of influence. And so let me just mention four things pretty quickly that I think Newbegin and Kuiper together. I draw upon Abraham Kuiper and Leslie Newbegin together.
So if you have another kid, are you going to name him Newbegin?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess I'd have to pray about that one.
I bet your wife would be praying about that one.
Little Newbegin, little Leslie Ashford. If I named him Leslie, he'd grow up to be a country singer and write a song entitled "A Boy Named Leslie," you know, and he'd be roped into, you know, giving me a good whipping.
If you're a dude listening and your name is Les or Leslie, please forward all of your emails to Bruce Ashford at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary.
That's right. My email is marty.durin at lifeway.com.
So you have four things, and this brings me to another question. When you get home in the evenings, do you tell your wife, here's two things you need to do, and tell your kids, here's three things you need to do? Everything is a
Marty,
number with you.
This, you know, this is getting very uncomfortable. It reminds me of middle school. Being stuck like in the middle of a circle of people making fun of me. It hurts. Frankly, it hurts my feelings.
I'm going to take a seminary class with you just so I can ask questions.
There's two kinds of people in the world. People who see the world in two categories and people who don't. No, but I do. I've got a good list of four, if you'll let me give it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I think, when we find ourselves decentered, and when we find ourselves in a position, humanly speaking, a position of political weakness, there are four things we can do. One is that we can consistently find ways to recenter God, to call attention back to the cosmic King. So let me divide that into three. One thing we can do is to emphasize the biblical narrative, to frame the Bible story of the world, and to let that frame the way we view things instead of letting MSNBC or CNN or Fox frame the way we see the world.
Mm-hmm.
A second thing we can do is we can find the idols that people tend to worship, that we tend to worship in public life, and we can make clear that Christ is Lord and those idols are not. Then a third thing I would say is that we can find ways to make clear that our ultimate allegiance is to Christ and not to a political party or political ideology. I don't think there's anything wrong with having a certain level of allegiance to a political party or ideology, but we have to always find ways of making clear that our ultimate allegiance is to Christ. Occupants to Caesar's throne come and go, but Jesus remains forever. So we want to recenter God. At the same time, and this is number two, we want to decenter the self. So take the spotlight off of ourself and put it on Christ and on our neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
So one way we can do that is by seeking the good of the city, Jeremiah 29, 5 through 7, rather than merely seeking the good of our own tribe. We do not want to be viewed as the special interest arm of the GOP, just merely seeking our own interests as evangelicals or white evangelicals or whoever it is that we are. We want to seek the good of the whole nation. And so it takes the focus off of us and lets us serve not only our own tribe, if you will, but other tribes or other people groups. And a second way of decentering the self is in our public debates and discussions, whether that happens on a Facebook page or in a coffee shop conversation, or if it's a debate between two politicians on television, we saw a few of these the past couple years, is to be concerned not only with the truth content of our moral and political stances, but also with the way in which we communicate them. We need to be able to stand there in the moment, and no matter what anyone says to us, for us to refuse to demean and degrade the people on the other side of the aisle, to refuse to treat them as thoroughly, morally reprehensible people in whom nothing good can be found.
You mean that's happening?
From time to time. I mean, it's such a mephitic and effluvial, just noxious, toxic political environment that we've got going on. And it's very tempting when people are misrepresenting you purposefully, degrading you. It's very difficult not to do the same thing back. But we've got to learn to be tough and to take firm stances on things without also losing our religion.
I would I would echo that and say that one of the I think, and I spend a lot of time on social media, both job related and just personal enjoyment, and it is a tremendous challenge and very frustrating at times to see people that I know are believers or at least claim to be believers who cannot seem to find a way to speak the truth in love. They cannot seem to find gentleness as a fruit of the Spirit. Everything is an 11. There doesn't seem to be either one of these is true, an ability or an interest in finding a common ground from which to carry on a conversation. It's all atom bombs all the time. And if we as believers are going to be missional in this particular moment in which we live, we have got to do a much better job of learning how to communicate with people with whom we disagree, even major disagreements.
Yeah, and if you just look at the pundits, the television hosts and radio hosts, there aren't many of them. You could count them on the one hand of a bad woodshop teacher.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't many of them who keep their civility in the middle of an exchange. There aren't many of them who refuse to misrepresent their opponent. We've got to find a way of doing that. Third thing that we can do is reframe issues. If the biblical narrative really does frame the way we see the world, then by necessity, we will be reframing different issues. It could the gospel and the biblical narrative could reframe our approach to money by showing people that is neither our savior nor our security, and by causing us to be radically generous to the economically disadvantaged. So, for example, even a conservative who thinks that the best way to help people who are financially disadvantaged is not through the federal government, but through society's mediating institutions, that conservative can be personally very generous to the economically disadvantaged and can articulate genuine love and concern. And I think many, you know, political conservatives don't articulate that and don't show it. That's just one example. That's just money.
Sure.
I think the biblical narrative reframes the way we approach gender, sexuality, power, you know, where we use our power to empower other people and decenter ourselves rather than empowering ourselves and decentering others.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do that, if we can reframe issues in an honest and genuine way that helps society, we will regain the distinctiveness, the clarity, and the power of our voice. We'll become interesting again. We've become very uninteresting in the past 20 years. We sound like a foghorn, and we're not differentiated from unbelievers in the tone of our discourse or in our political approach.
And that is important. We seem to place the emphasis on the fact that we differ in the either the process or the results or the positions, but we don't seem to think it important to differ in the way that we're articulating those things.
And we have to do it.
I agree.
I mean, if evangelicals won't do it, then who will? This is our moment, I think. This is our this could be a major contribution to help bring healing and redirection to our nation. The final category that I've got is revitalizing culture. I think Christ-centered cultural activity and culture work and culture making is a powerful means of opposing social, cultural, and political decadence. But culture work is hard work.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be willing to play the long game. Don't put all of your hopes in short-term political activism. When you put all of your hopes in short-term political activism, you're tempted to sacrifice your long-term witness on the altar of a short-term political gain of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to play the long game. How can we be the most powerful witness and the best influence on our culture over a 30-year run, over a 50-year stretch? And then involved in that is also taking the broad view. That means not putting all of our eggs in the basket of politics. Politics is one realm of culture. You've also got art and education and science and family and church. And so we want to bring renewal and revitalization to each of these realms. And then when we have strong Christian witness in each of them, sort of networked together with arms locked together, the witness and the influence is all the more powerful. So much more so than if we put all of our influence into political political activism.
You know, that's interesting because you don't often see evangelicals arguing over who's the best, Southern Gothic novelist, or who's the best Renaissance era painter, or who's the best impressionist. I mean, it's like we don't spend any time in those categories at all, so we don't have any input into conversations about those categories. So we tend to all gather at, for lack of a better term, right now, I'll just say the least common denominator, which right now seems to be political argumentation, more so even than political discussion. So how can we, and I'm going to add this question so, you don't have to expound on a long time if you don't want, but how then do we, if we need to do those things, then what's a good tool to begin to retrain our thinking of how do I spend less time debating about a political or a policy position, and how do I spend more time expanding my intake of other parts of culture like the arts or literature or whatever?
Yeah, good point. Just to get practical handles, I'm going to have to promote a book that I wrote here. I wrote a book called Every Square Inch, An Introduction to Cultural Engagement for Christians.
I have promoted that book a lot more than you have.
Thank you for that.
I sure have. I've given away copies. I've recommended it. I've used it. It's a great book.
I wrote it as a first entrance for someone who's really, really just beginning to think about how can I interact in the arts, sciences, public square, education, and so forth. Mm-hmm. I think as we mentioned in our last podcast, there's three questions we have to ask in each of these spheres of culture. What is God's creational design for it? How has it been corrupted and misdirected by sin? And how can we bring healing and redirection to it? And those three questions are easy to ask, difficult to answer, but that gives a little bit of a guidance. Mm-hmm. So I think some good reading, the book that I wrote, I think it's a start. I would recommend a book called Living at the Crossroads by Craig Bartholomew and Michael Goheen. I think that's really helpful. And then a third book, there's a book entitled Culture Matters by T.M. Moore, and it's basically six little mini biographies of culture influencers, either people or communities who have influenced culture in some especially helpful way. So doing a little reading, I think, is helpful. I think pastors, it would be helpful if we would emphasize to our congregations and to encourage in our young people the view that these other realms of culture matter. They matter just like it matters to be a pastor or a missionary. That no matter where God places you in life, in public life, that place is a vantage point from which to be to take a missionary approach, to use the cultural opportunities that God gives us as leverage to teach people to look to the biblical narrative for the answers, mm-hmm. as leverage to show the beauty of Christ. And when we begin to realize this, and when we begin to realize that we can give a powerful witness from a position of public weakness, whether it's politics or art or science or education, when we begin to realize that, I think we become alive inside spiritually.
So, Bruce, let me wrap this up with a quote from The Gospel in a Pluralist Society by Leslie Newbegin. This is very short. When the church tries to embody the rule of God in the forms of earthly power, it may achieve that power, but it is no longer a sign of the kingdom. And hearing your discussion today about Newbegin and missional living and how it relates to culture and specifically the political sphere, I would hope that we would strive in our preaching and in our teaching and in our encouragement and our one-on-one discipleship or small group discipleship that we don't want to fall into the error of trying to win the world using not, what some people complain about as worldly methodologies, but actually the temptations of the world's system, so that even if we can claim some kind of victory, that it actually doesn't point to the kingdom of God, but it's just a replication of some aspect of the kingdoms of man. So I want to thank you for being on Pastor Talk again. You're always a good guest and always thought-provoking. And until the next time, I hope everything is going well for you, brother.
Thank you, Marty. It's been a great joy. I appreciate it.
Pastor Talk is the podcast of Lifeway Pastors and is hosted by Marty Duran. That's me. Join us each week as I interview pastors, authors, professors, and others to help your ministry as you seek to shepherd your flock well. Until next time, this is Marty Duran.